And I must apologise also that my talk is heavy on images and less on speech or print. I put a certain amount of print in the images, but I didn't have very long to prepare it because I got other work in hand. And then I was very kindly introduced by Stephen King by my daughter to Ed, and he decided, yes, he'd like a paper on European appreciation, shall we say, of an interface with the elephant in probably from the early Middle Ages onwards. Of course, it's an enormous enormous story, even if you narrow it down to images and sculpture, which on the whole I'm working on, it's nevertheless almost, it's far too huge for 20 minutes. But what's fascinated me today, I must say, is I've been very impressed with the way that other speakers' papers on foreign parts, particularly Doris's last one, obviously is actually interlocks like that with my story. I mean, the elephant in Milan that you showed used to be called by Leonardo, which is amusing and interesting. And since any sort of publication, I've noticed that in the Vatican ceiling, can you imagine one of the most known cycles of art in the whole world, let alone Europe, I noticed an elephant the other day. So I went to my friend in Cambridge, Paul Galides, who's the international Michelangelo expert, and even he said, no, no one has ever noticed it that I'm aware of. So I'll present that another time. It's to do with the elephant, but not on what we're talking about today. Favourite animal worldwide? Well, even wider than I was thinking when I said, because of today's comments, and I look forward to the publications of the various papers so I can cross-reference into my work. Very positive vibes, except when the male is outraged, of course, fair enough, it applies to almost everybody. I had a rather interesting chance that I was beginning this lecture just with an English reference, the two of the coats of arms, the one on your right, the Worshipful Company of Cutlers, because cutlers were involved with elephants. Why? Because knife handles of the top class were made out of slivers of elephant tusk. And it was in the centre of my screen. Then Ed very kindly, I think, sent me a scan of his last talk, as a talk at the last conference of 2016 on the elephant in England, and with the wonderful coat of arms of SOAS on the top. So I thought, well, two beginnings for the two conferences, and I'm a complete outsider. I'm a newcomer into your field of interest and into SOAS. It's the first time I've ever been here, although I used to haunt the Warburg next door. I think there the explanation of the difference between the cutler's elephant and the SOAS elephant is that the SOAS one is clearly, as we've learnt today from the paper about the Illustrated London News, was from the height of the British Empire. I don't know, what was the foundation date of SOAS? It's obviously the height of...
1916.
Oh, as late as that? Oh, well, it's a little bit afterwards. But isn't he a Victorian gentleman in a corset and a tight waistcoat? He's a typical clubman. He's standing upright with his shoulders back and proceeding as a gentleman should do along Pell-Mell or Piccadilly. Stepping back in time, and this is totally en passant, but not all of you would know the arms of the city of Oxford. You may well know the university arms, but the city of Oxford, one of its supporters, better shown in the miniature on your left, is actually an elephant which has got decorations on it, the coat of arms of Francis Knollys, as you can see the details on the left, and it was chosen. The other creature is actually a beaver, which equally was the coat of arms of another local grandee. And when you go to the Knollys church somewhere in, I think it's in Berkshire, you will find lots of lovely elephants, which I won't go on with today. Well, my subtitle to this one is Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. I say that with some degree of rancour, because the recent legislation about import and sale of ivory in our country, we've copied the American legislation of Hillary Clinton, the French legislation, is far too extreme and wasn't necessary from the point of view of historic products, because they have no effect on current day poaching. And it has, one previous speaker did say that the elephant was a commodity, or indeed a product, if you like. It wasn't regarded as a nice, cuddly creature at all. was often inimical, obviously, to humankind, in for the reasons that the last speaker this morning mentioned, that there was an interface of our invasion of what was its territory. But this is Piazza Armerina. Some of you may have visited there. It's right in the centre of Sicily. Difficult to get at unless you go on a guided bus tour. And this is one of the central items there, personifying India. But you'll notice that the main feature on the left is a baby elephant. I used to think they had nets on them, but actually that is a stylization used by the Romans for the hide of an elephant. There's something called a Pashley sarcophagus in the Antiquities Department in the Fitzwilliam in Cambridge, where the elephant has exactly this crisscross pattern. They couldn't be bothered to make it realistic, perhaps didn't know how they went. And on, you see the good lady is actually holding a tusk, and there's another one flying in midair behind a tiger. And the idea is, these are some of the only clues to the possible owner, that they think he may have been an importer of exotic beasts, most probably Sicily being twixt Africa and Europe, via North Africa, maybe from Africa itself, or I only learnt this afternoon when someone mentioned Yemen as a route across from the east, which, to be honest, I was unaware until today. I was thinking of silk routes and so on. But it was obviously part of this international trade of total deluxe objects. Well, how could us white Europeans in northern Europe in bad climate, with the Atlantic Ocean between us and most things, bring an elephant from the Far East to Europe? Well, if you notice on the right, we've got Sir Thomas More's A Wood Engraving, introducing More's Utopia. And in it, I'm using it really to show a ship in mid-sail between some ideal, imagined in this case, exotic destination well beyond the seas. And there you see, with its sails down, probably at anchor, a typical vessel of about 1518. I'm showing you on your left a similar vessel by Bruegel, a man of war of about 1560. And I think at the time, for great long international voyages, there wouldn't have been much distinction between merchantmen and, as we'd say, naval vessels, i.e. armed vessels a la Spanish Armada. They were the modern technology of the day, of course, as we know from recent discoveries in our country of the Mary Rose on our part. It was apparently the most heavily armed war machine ever in the time of Henry VIII. I used to think they were on the deck making their messes and they could be shoved over the side by able seamen so-and-so and eating fodder there, but I realised they really must, I think, have been in the hold because otherwise they might have escaped or fallen overboard somehow. And it was a long route. There on the right is an earlier vessel, the 1460s, from the Ashmolean Museum collection. And I put it here in a symbolic way, passing, as it were, the bell and tower of Lisbon, through which that port of Lisbon was the one through which the vast majority of elephants then became dispersed across northern Europe, seemed to have been landed, and indeed the Portuguese, having established their rights to the eastern hemisphere in 1510 by the gift of Hanno, who's on your left, to Pope Leo X, actually established their rights there, and he would have been such an elephant. He was actually walked across most of Spain, then shipped, I think, across, not to Rome, but Genoa, and then walked down the coast, accompanied by none other than the famous explorer Tristan da Cunha. I mean, talk about celebrities. And Pope Leo fell in love with this baby elephant. It was a 10-year-old, so very amenable by then. It's obviously got a mahout and a trainer, if you like, to distinguish them, both with the typical ankush, the elephant hook, by which they pass messages by tapping it on the skull with this nasty pointed implement. And he was of great fame, much over loved and attended in the Vatican. I think fed too many equivalents of the current bun by the Italians. And they did indeed, all over Europe, I'm afraid, we liked to see the fun and games if we made an elephant drunk, mostly on beer, particularly in Germany. There are many accounts of getting the poor animal drunk and then behaving as a human being behaves when drunk. But there he is, very tame. And believe it or not, this is a lovely, lovely sketch which still survives, but it was for a life-size fresco of Hanno on a gateway to the Vatican. Alas, this gateway was destroyed by none other than one of my heroes, Bernini, when he built the great piazza, because the bulging arms of his piazza knocked against an earlier gate with a silly old Raphael fresco on it, so bang went the ball of the bulldozer. Anyway, there we are, that's the history of it. And you can see that, therefore, that image was preserved by posterity, at least from 1510 to something like 1665, when the Chigi Pope erected the great piazza of St. Peter's. Well, really, probably everyone in the room knows these basic facts, but in case anyone doesn't, and I'm no expert, I'm cribbing two nice diagrams from various books on this question, the elephant and its ivory. And you can see on the right is the biological cross-section, the dental one, showing the dentine coat, the nerve canal in the centre, which is very annoying because it goes all the way to the tip. So even though we call it a solid shaft of ivory, it's not solid, it's got a hole down the middle. And if you reveal that hole, it tends to look darker, and you can see it on many ivory statuettes. If the carver even got it right, there's still going to be probably the traces of the hole right up in the tip near the top, and if you cut it off to make hair, suddenly a hole would emerge. On the left, out of my colleague, dear Marjorie O'Halley Trusted, recent book on the making of sculpture. She's just catalogued the V&A ivories, incidentally, big, enormous and wonderful catalogue, very expensive, but well illustrated. Anyway, in the booklet that preceded it, you get this lovely diagram, and the bottom one is very useful to us, who are interested in the sculpting of bits of elephant tusk, because it shows the more or less solid tip, and then the hollow part, which, as you see in that case, can be sliced, as it were, by a bread machine, and I'll show you more of that anon. We already saw that very, very nice picture, I think from Japan, of a Japanese craftsman doing exactly this sort of cutting of a tusk. I mean, it's fairly much common sense once you get used to elephant tusks. That's how you get the most possible use. Very rare, very precious, even a sliver of ivory was preserved and has been almost until our own times in our Western culture. It's not necessarily a question of, you know, bad-mouthing the Chinese because we were using the elephant ivory in exactly the same way for many centuries, partly in parallel, but not perhaps any more today. On the downside, I have to say that it's a known fact that I read in one of Bill Bryson's books called Made in the USA about American culture and the growth of the middle classes, which again was mentioned vis-a-vis the Illustrated London News, that in the Middle West, anyone who aspired to be middle class, the man had to play billiards, and the best billiard balls still are, I believe, ivory. Enormous use of the solid. You're going to get about one or two maximum balls out of one tusk, and the ladies had to have a piano. And that is where the text comes from, of tinkling the ivories, this well-known expression, because it's exactly that. And those were all bits of elephant, and absolutely hundreds of thousands of elephants were hunted and destroyed and brought over to the USA and England. So we all have quite a lot on our conscience. On the right is a very useful picture which illustrates a real tusk from a recent issue of the National Geographic magazine, which I saw in the dentist's waiting room, as one does, and there was an article about poaching in the Central African Republic, as you can see from the left, but illuminated from within, quite handy for our purpose of seeing exactly such a plaque, in this case being cut off on its own and brought out of the tusk to reveal it. And they also put in that very useful map at the top showing, I think, the routes from India and other parts of the Far East pre the rounding of the Cape of Good Hope in southern Africa by the Portuguese in the late 15th century. And on the left, another type of artifact, a book cover in this case, but showing the use of different plaques of ivory, individual plaques, all fixed together on some sort of substructure, probably of wood in this case. But inside this, there is the frieze across the bottom, which shows very much exactly the same dramatis personae as that lovely mosaic from Sicily, i.e. elephant trophies, the tusks and the beasts. One baby elephant being brought along from, what is it, your left, and with a tiger beside it. And then on the left side of that actual object, there is a man giving, bringing rings, and these I think are rings of gold, because gold and tusks have been the products that were imported from Egypt from since time immemorial. They appear in Egyptian images of their culture, and here they are again in what is by now an early Christian ivory.